and that's the kicky music that means it's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, we're in the future, or possibly the past, as we talk about time travel movies, including the current Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Bruce Willis vehicle, Looper. We'll also take one of your suggestions and tackle the question of pop culture entry points. How do you know what's the right place for someone to jump into something that you think they should try? And as always, we'll wrap up with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I cover movies, theater, pop culture, that sort of thing. And I'm the guy at NPR who says Viola when he meant Porsche.
Aww. Well, fortunately,
I was gonna say
something. Thousands of people on the internet to correct it for you. And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, I'm awfully glad to see all of you this week, as always. And I believe we did a little homework this time around. We have seen Looper.
Mm-hmm. We have,
all of us. It's been a while since we did a movie assignment, but we tried this one. Trey, you saw this movie back in Toronto when we were there for the film festival. I did not see it at that time. What did you think?
I thought it was pretty stylish. It was a lot of fun. A slow patch in the middle, but nice surprises toward the end.
How did you enjoy the prosthetic makeup?
I did not enjoy the prosthetic makeup. It was rather distracting.
I think before we talk about this movie, we should say we will try not to give away sort of endings and resolutions to major questions, but there's really no way to talk about this movie without giving away sort of pieces of what the premise is and what's going on and what the major questions turn out to be.
And I think most of those are in the trailer.
Yeah. Absolutely. And if you read basic descriptions. So the reason for the prosthetic makeup is that Joseph Gordon-Levitt is playing a younger version of the same character that Bruce Willis is playing. And of course, if you look at them naturally, Bruce Willis and Joseph Gordon-Levitt not necessarily looking like they were separated at birth. Mm-hmm. So they have given Joseph Gordon-Levitt a little bit of makeup to sort of plump out the face a little bit, give him the Bruce Willis nose, give him a little bit of the Bruce Willis forehead.
The Joan Crawford eyebrows.
I think they thinned down his lips in some odd way.
Yeah, that's very possible. How about you, Glenn? How did you respond to this movie?
I dug it. You know, a lot of attention is getting paid to Joseph Gordon-Levitt's makeup job, but when you don't shave Bruce Willis's head and you leave that horseshoe, like shaven head, badass. But leave the horseshoe, Alan Arkin.
Yes!
It's like my Uncle Leonard.
Alan Arkin is pretty badass in Wait Until Dark.
Well, that's true. But I dug it. This is one of the kind of time travel stories, and we'll talk about a few different kinds, but this is the kind of time travel story I really get into, which is where the main character intersects his own timeline, and there's real consequences, and things can change. I'm less sold on the time is immutable and the future is set and the past is set and you must meet your destiny.
Yeah.
And another way to classify that kind of movie is, why am I watching this if I know what's going to happen?
If everything is predestined.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. But this was really, really well handled. They talked about the messiness of the time paradoxes by dismissing it with a wave of a hand, by saying, it gets cloudy. Don't break your head.
It was kind of, there was a little bit of something with magnets.
Right.
How about you, Stephen?
You know, I liked this movie. The words I used, I actually happened to see this movie with my pal Linda Holmes, and the words I used as we were walking out of the theater was, that was innovative but unpleasant.
Uh-huh.
And Trey used the word fun. And while I found it engrossing, and while I found it basically well made, and it, you know, it has some compelling ideas, there's very little like that I would point to and say, this is wrong with this movie,
mm-hmm.
which leads me to my own personal biases a little bit. And I tend not to love movies in which people are sort of lavishly blown away over and over again.
Moments of those.
I also have just a massive hang up about bad things happening to kids.
Right.
And there are a couple, and they try very hard to keep that off screen. You don't see.
But
you
know, they walk right up to it.
Mm-hmm. They walk right up to it. They
make it hard to watch.
There's horrible violence against children, and I really, really, really struggle with that. And that does not equal a criticism of the movie. It's sort of a personal bias.
It's a taste thing.
It's a taste thing that I struggle with, and it actually, interestingly, as much as you're supposed to sort of question all these things about time and fate and whatever, and it, you know, it does raise those questions, I found myself sort of analyzing, like, this really makes me think about movie criticism and how would I write a review of this movie because it's good but not to my taste.
Well, Mo Ryan, who writes at the now at the Huffington Post about television, has sort of talked a lot about the difference between not good and not for me.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think this, I had sort of the same reaction that you did, Stephen, that I definitely respect and admire the filmmaking that went into this, and yet in a lot of ways not for me, because I have watched plenty of violent movies. I love Die Hard. There's lots of shooting
in Die Hard. You love Cabin in the Woods, which is...
I loved Cabin in the Woods. There is something about the type of, as you say, the way that people are sort of gloriously blown away.
It's cavalier about it.
And one of the things that's interesting is that Rian Johnson, who wrote and directed this movie, has also done a couple of episodes of Breaking Bad. So this is kind of an area of, I think, some familiarity in working in these really, really dark stories. Mm. He also did Brick, which is terrific, by the way, if you haven't seen it. It's sort of a film noir set in a high school, and it also had Joseph Gordon-Levitt. It's a terrific, odd movie I liked a lot. But he does kind of enjoy these really sort of dark settings, and I think I wasn't terribly surprised by the amount of violence, partly because I had read about it. Mm-hmm. But for me, it just reaches a point where it's just very hard for me to watch. I mean, anybody who has watched this kind of movie with me has seen me sitting there with my fingers over my ears, because that's what happens when I watch this kind of movie. I don't like waiting around for people to get shot in the face.
And you're right about the cavalier quality of the way the loopers are dispatched and are dispatching others. But there's also there's a very different kind of violence that's applied to people who break the code.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that violence sits at an intersection of savagery and sadism.
There's a tiny...
There's a little bit of glee built into
there's
it.
There's an early bit of kind of torture porn.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, there's a scene or two of mayhem, of carnage, which is played for sort of adrenaline thrill. Mm-hmm. And I'll admit, I felt a little adrenaline thrill. I kind of dug that scene. There is something else. There's another aspect, almost another entire storyline in this film, which is mentioned at the very, very beginning of the film. So if you want to skip ahead just a little bit. But there's a whole telekinesis element to this film, which doesn't graph directly over the time travel element. It's sort of added in there.
No, agreed.
Now, it results in some pretty cool visuals. I'm not going to say it doesn't look cool. I'm not questioning the premise. Again, science fiction, not science boring. I don't care why it happens. They just said, gene. Somebody had a gene. The gene mutated and people could now move things with their mind. If I rebelled at that, I would be rebelling against everything I've read since I was age 7 to age now, because that's pretty much the whole X-Men thing. But it did feel like, I kept thinking about what the film would be like without that element, and I think it would, the stakes would be a little bit lower for reasons we won't get into.
Sure.
But it would, I don't think I'd miss it that much.
Well, it is interesting. I mean, you sort of establish, like, this is envisioning a future in which one incredibly key thing is different. Mm-hmm. But when the future has two incredibly key things that are different, there is a little bit of, like, that's, my mind can't deal with
that. Yeah. One of the things I think is interesting about it is that it's both a dystopian future movie and a time travel movie. Both genres frequently seen, not always together, sometimes together. Mm-hmm. But what struck me watching it is that movies about a dystopian future are very often, although not always, about whether hope can survive, right? Mm-hmm. How bleak can the world become, and can you still have hope? And one of the things I thought was interesting about combining it with a time travel movie is that the particular way the time travel works and plays out in this movie, because you get kind of one of these questions about, let us say, a horrible future is set in stone, right, is going to happen. You know it's going to happen because you've been visited by someone from the future who told you about it. Mm-hmm. It takes one of the main questions of time travel, which is what Dan Coyce in the spoiler special podcast on Slate called the baby Hitler question, which is the, would you kill Hitler as a baby if you had the chance? There's some exploring of similar questions in this movie, and because of that, it becomes a movie partly about, can you be optimistic about the future despite absolute contrary evidence? Right. So when you talk about a dystopia, you're sort of talking about, so the world becomes incredibly bleak. Can you remain hopeful? Now you're talking about, you've actually seen how much bleaker and worse it's going to get. Can you still find a way to become hopeful or optimistic that that future can be avoided in any way other than killing baby Hitler. Do you know what I mean?
Right, right. Right.
So in a way,
right. it's already gotten bad.
Right.
Is it going to get worse?
So in a way, they become, they're both kinds of movies that often are about the survival or lack of survival of optimism.
Right. But what this movie gets right about science fiction and speculative fiction of any kind is that in such cases, the metaphor is what's actually happening emotionally. So the metaphor of time travel, can you change the future, is the question, do you change? Can you change who
right.
you are?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, you know, ideally, the smarter people who are writing science fiction and fantasy are kind of playing with. The people who aren't dealing with the emotional aspect of it and just saying, wouldn't it be cool if we could travel back to Pilgrim days? I mean, that's not, it doesn't address it. And I thought that there was a real emotional through line to this that really worked for me.
Yeah, the Joseph Gordon-Levitt's character undertakes a classic hero's journey.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I think you're absolutely right. I think that is something that time travel movies are often about. I think the only other thing I can think of a good one being about is essentially the Back to the Future, which is really about having the opportunity to, in that case, learn something about your parents
right.
by sort of stepping out of the fact that time always places you at one point, not only in your own development, but in everyone else's.
Mm-hmm.
And so time travel in that situation is a way for him to gain a completely different perspective. That is kind of the fourth dimension kind of thing when mm-hmm. you think about the X and Y and Z axis,
sure.
axis and then the time, right?
Yeah, it's another great example of the movie like Glenn was talking about in the beginning about, you know, fate is this non-existent thing, really. That, you know, at best, it's malleable, you know, where the actions in the past, every action in the past affects the future. And so if you go back into the past, blah, blah, blah. You know, so I think Back to the Future is a great example of that, you know, with the added dimension of the kind of nifty generation. I love Back to the Future.
Yeah, me too.
Okay. I'm going to bust out a taxonomy here.
I'm so glad.
You get your three different kinds of time travel movies, pop culture, television. The first is where the past and the future is simply another country, a place you visit, where you kind of take a whistle-stop tour. So this is your...
Meet George Jetson?
Well, I mean, that's not actually
not time travel. Just takes place.
But, like, so H.G. Wells' The Time Machine. He goes forward.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really affect his own timeline in any way. It's just a place he goes to. It could be another planet. Same thing with Time Bandits. They keep hopping around. Doesn't really affect... They don't create any paradoxes. It's just mm-hmm. about visiting all these places. Time After Time, a really great very 80s, Nicholas Meyer directed film about H.G. Wells, played by Malcolm McDowell, who goes into the future, San Francisco, chasing David Warner, who plays Jack the Ripper, who was born to play Jack the Ripper.
And the really bad one where Meg Ryan is like the advertising lady and Hugh Jackman comes
is
18th
that
century.
Kate and Leopold?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Now that I put into this weird category of the Bewitched, you know, Sam.
Yeah.
You brought Napoleon over into the kitchen, but now we have to close the Waterloo cigarettes account. What are we going to do? You know?
Yeah.
Okay, but Time After Time is lovely. And
Time After Time is great.
I'm sorry. Yes, I messed up your taxonomy. Go back to your taxonomy.
Bill and Ted, 80 to 90% of Doctor Who is this kind of thing, where they don't actually go in their own timeline. They're just going to a different time. Connecticut Yankee and King Arthur's Court.
Mm-hmm.
So the second kind is where what we were talking about before. Time is fixed. Destiny is immutable. It cannot be changed. Why am I watching this? 12 Monkeys. A film I didn't dig, but everybody's telling me to see Le Jeté, which is based on a short film that it's based on. Final Countdown. This is a film about a aircraft carrier
really
that goes
great rock band.
Back in time. Yes,
about a band called Europe.
Oh, I've seen that.
Yeah, they go back in time to right before Pearl Harbor, and the entire movie is, what would we do? Can we attack the Japanese? And then, of course, at the end of the film, the choice is made for them, exactly. Peggy Sue Got Married, just bite me. Groundhog Day, to a certain extent. Groundhog Day is about getting it right. There is only one right answer to this day, and when he gets it right...
It's another hero's journey.
But I think most of them are kind of what I would consider the wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey, you know, you interfere with your own timeline kind of thing. And Back to the Future 2 plays more into this than certainly Back to the Future 1 or 3. Hot Tub Time Machine plays into this.
That's true.
The classic example, Stephen, is the Treehouse of Horror, The Simpsons.
Yes.
Treehouse of Horror, where he goes back and he
I wasn't going to mention just because I keep mentioning The Simpsons, but it really is wonderful.
Donnie Darko, Time Cop, which I remember not only because Jean-Claude Van Damme does splits on his kitchen counter.
Yes, he does.
Although that is a factor. The Butterfly Effect, which is a terrible movie, but certainly plays with it. Most of Star Trek, like pretty much any, like Star Trek IV, Star Trek First Contact, Star Trek Generations, Yesterday's Enterprise, Cause and Effect, the J.J. Abrams Star Trek, all these kind of play with that trope. So what do you guys think of this taxonomy, like these three different kinds of films? I mean, to me, the ones that are most interesting are the ones where things can change irrevocably. The film is a different film at the end.
The issue I have, and I think this is sort of what Looper does, I think, correctly, sort of the only way it can. The only way you can really make this work to me is to be able to envision that there are multiple timelines. Mm-hmm. So the only thing you can really do if you travel back in the future and change it is create an additional different timeline mm-hmm. that goes differently.
The sliding doors effect.
Yeah, actually. Because otherwise, you immediately run into all of the paradoxes even harder, even faster. Because, for example, in the case of this movie, we already know that that Bruce Willis has progressed to be 30 years older than Joseph Gordon-Levitt in some version of the world without the things happening that are happening when they meet up back in 2044.
Right.
So you have to sort of posit that there are multiple versions of reality. And what I like about that is that it's not that time is immutable. It's that they don't actually all happen. Mm-hmm. But it is true of any of us that there are many possible ways that your life could go, and you're only ever going to get to see one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we, after we leave this room, go to one place, one thing will happen. And if we go to another place, another thing will happen. So all of those timelines sort of quote-unquote exist right now.
Right.
But we will only ever get to see one of them.
Hey, Linda, you just blew my mind.
And so what I like about time travel movies is when they allow you to play with that idea that there are a lot of ways that things can play out, and that you will only ever get to see one of the possibilities.
Sure.
What I don't like is when they try to make it all one thing. Like, when you sort of wind up with something where they're trying to imply that the time travel itself leads to the events that
right.
create the time travel.
Right.
So you're kind of trying to posit that there's only one.
Yeah,
and that's... you're sort of redoing it so it's different.
Right.
I don't like that.
That's the 12 monkeys. That's exactly what happened.
I don't like that.
Yeah.
I don't like that. I don't like it when they try to say that only with the time travel can the time travel happen. That freaks me out. I don't like it, and I get upset.
It's like an endless feedback loop.
I get upset.
I just want to know where the charming film Somewhere in Time features in your taxonomy.
Well, where would it go? I guess it's like he just goes back. He just kind of dreams himself
He hypnotizes himself back.
So that's almost like another country. I don't think it really affects his timeline except he disappears. That's based on Richard Matheson short story, I think. But the technique of going back in time like that is from the Jack Finney novels, Time and Again, and a bunch of things like that. So actually the professor in that film is named Professor Finney, the one who teaches him that effect, thing like that. There's also, of course, Quantum Leap.
We've
got to talk about Quantum Leap. Now, the thing I have against Quantum Leap is I was a little too old for it when it came on, and that's like one of these things where it's not really time travel. It's basically like we go back in time, and then it's like somebody learns a lesson. Prejudice is bad, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I think toward the end of the series, they started playing with time, and he got into his own timeline and things like that. But for most of it, it was more like The Incredible Hulk.
I think my mother is somewhere shaking her fist at the line that you were too old for it.
Well, it just didn't grab me.
Yeah.
I do want to give a shout out to a special kind of time travel, which doesn't happen within the actual... The characters don't time travel. The audience does. So in a lot of Quentin Tarantino films, he will chop up the narrative so that we will meet a character, we will see that character's death, but then the closing image of the film, and I'm thinking here of Pulp Fiction.
So this is just scrambled chronology more than time travel.
But it is a form of time travel for us, and it feels... When I see Pulp Fiction and a character gets blown away, but then the final scene of the film is that character alive and well, there's a kind of benevolence to that choice. Something like this happens in a book by Chris Ware, which just came out. It's actually a series of books called Building Stories. 14 different comics in this box, this giant box, which all take place at different times. So depending on which order you read them in, you kind of make the characters live or die.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of a temporal grace.
Chris Ware.
This is fantastic, but that feeling of not knowing which one to pick up, and depending on what you do, you are time traveling as opposed to the characters.
That sort of set of options is not present in the Cloud Atlas, but the type of time travel you're describing is sort of the core of that story.
Well, right? And it's true in Memento, too.
I was just going to say Memento.
I think when I saw Memento, you can know intellectually that you're watching a movie that has essentially a backwards timeline, but you can't really process that one thing is the beginning and one thing is the end.
Right.
I mean, when I thought about that story later, it was like, that's why people made these things that were like, I made a thing where it's Memento, but it's in the right order.
Right.
It's because you can't really,
yeah.
You can't make your brain process a story backwards. You
sure.
can't. It's impossible to do. So, I mean, you're always, in a sense, when you're reading a narrative, you're always going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Always. You're
mm-hmm.
always going forward. So if you're also going backward, mm-hmm. it works on the reader like time travel.
Well, the thing with Memento, of course, is it's basically like a Columbo where you see the killing in the beginning, and then it's the whole thing is determining
mm-hmm.
how. I mean,
right.
so Memento, you're just solving a mystery by going backwards.
Yeah, but I still feel like it has that quality of, like, you're going forward and backward in that story at the same time.
Sure.
And I think it is displacing in that way.
The classic theater example, Trey, you want to jump in here?
I'm not sure what you might be thinking of.
I stumped the band.
You did.
Harold Pinter's Betrayal.
Oh, yes.
Which starts with a couple breaking up, and each successive scene is earlier and earlier in their relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So you walk out of the theater with them first meeting. It's kind of
There is also a rather fun experiment in the musical theater called The Last 5 Years, in which the guy is moving forward in time and the woman is moving backward in time. So there's only one scene where they're telling the story of their relationship,
mm-hmm.
right? He's telling it from start to finish. She's telling it from end to start. And so there's only one scene in the middle when they're talking about the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And so you watch him fall in love
mm-hmm.
as you watch
mm-hmm.
her fall out of love
mm-hmm.
and then vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating. And it's a pretty solid little show.
And I feel like we should say before we get off of this that, of course, one of the most popular time travel stories in recent years, despite the fact that I doubt any of us has really taken it in, is Time Traveler's Wife.
Sure.
Which it posits a single person moving through time sort of involuntarily, which is a whole different... There's a very different idea of time travel where it's something you invent and then you do because it's cool
mm-hmm.
versus something that is incredibly disorienting and
happens to you.
And happens
right.
to you.
Mm-hmm. There was a TV show based on that premise, right? There were like three or four people who got caught up in experience called Sliders,
yeah,
yeah.
That goes back to your point. I mean, I'm putting that in the alternate universe box.
Yeah.
You, you would consider that time travel? You would, Linda Holmes.
I did not watch Sliders.
Okay.
So I could not speak knowledgeably about it. But.
Now, of course, Futurama did so many different
yeah.
episodes and different takes on it that you can't even put right. it into a taxonomy because they
right.
did it like 16 times.
Yeah.
That's true.
Well, I think in perfecting our taxonomy, we should ask anyone who is listening who is interested in this sort of thing to come to our Facebook page at facebook.com/PCHH or to the blog at npr.org/PCHH and talk to us a little bit about time travel, a little bit about what you think is most interesting, and, of course, about Looper. So one of the things that I would encourage you to talk about with us, if you choose, is what your entry point was into time travel literature. Once again, I'm just going to say Queen of the Segway.
There you go.
Right? No lie. One of our wonderful listeners was kind enough to share an idea with us for talking about pop culture entry points. Now, not just saying, here's my entry point into this, here's my entry point into this, but how you choose an entry point. And I think people think about this most in terms of when you are trying to get someone else into something, when you're trying to say to somebody, you should watch this show, you should listen to this musician, you should see the movies of this director. How do you decide where you want them to start? How do you decide what you want to recommend first? And so we thought we would talk a little bit about how we pick entry points. Trey Graham, let's start with you. Talk to me about this.
I actually have an anecdote that will end in an object lesson. And it's basically about how...
I start all my stories this way.
I have a fable.
Strap in.
This actually happened to me. This is a story of how I learned one of the key lessons of choosing a pop culture entry point. So it's 1992 or 93. We're in Chicago at the Lyric Opera House, and I'm trying to convince a relatively new boyfriend that opera is a good thing. Being young, in 1992, and being sort of an utter fool, I took him to see Pelléas and Mélisande with Teresa Stratus in the lead. Now, Teresa Stratus is a wonderful singing actress. See the film, the Zeffirelli's film of La Traviata, she's just completely luminous. And Pelléas and Mélisande is an important, extraordinary piece of work. It's musically sophisticated. It's dramatically inventive. What it is not is the most exciting opera in the world.
Mm-hmm.
It is not what you would call a jazzy show. There are no desperate Spanish soldier boys visiting domestic violence on an emotionally unavailable gypsy woman outside the Bullring. So Stephen slept through two-thirds of a $150 opera ticket, and I learned the lesson that when you program these get-acquainted experiences for your friends and colleagues and partners, you don't choose the material you would choose if you're trying to impress your teacher.
Right. Yeah. Good point.
I think that's a very good point.
There is no point in showing off here. You start off with your basic free baggie of crack, which in opera is your Carmens and your La Bohème's and your Madame Butterflies, or better yet, with one of those compilation albums like Puccini for Lovers or something.
You raise a good point about something I talk about like with the Grammys all the time, where I talk about the Grammys will lavishly praise accessible entry points into something that is forbidding. So, you know, the most right down the middle blues, the most right down the middle hip hop, the most right down the middle jazz, anything that crosses over is Grammy bait. And I think in part, one of the reasons for that is the Grammys are run by the music industry and they want to get people into new music. And I think when there's an artist or a director or an author that you're really excited about, you want to pick the thing that the person is most likely to love.
Right.
Now, you have to be very patient and you have to sort of be willing to let the person take the time to sort of get into it on their own. You know, my trick when I was married, I would put albums that I thought she would like, artists that I thought she would like, I would put the CD in the car stereo and set it so she would think it was coming on the radio. Because if I were, if I were like, you have to hear this album, you have to hear this artist, there was just no way she was going to do it.
Yeah.
Well, it's, and I think, and
I don't blame her at all
she's
for that.
Not alone.
Yeah.
And that was not unique to her in the slightest.
No.
The sit down and see if you have a discovery, and by the way, your husband's going to be really upset with you if you don't like it, is not a way.
Just picture you there. Wait. Right way. Go up. Hold on. There's next bit here.
This is a good part.
That's another great point.
You can't hover.
You don't want me in the room with you.
Yeah. See, I think that's a very important point.
And I think that's a great way to go about it. You let the person have some sense that they are making his or her own discovery. Because I would go through this process of like, you should check out Radiohead's The Bends. You will love it. And then 8 months later, she would hear Fake Plastic Trees on the radio and be like, I just heard this great new band.
Yeah.
But any listener, any reader, any moviegoer wants to have the sense that they make their own discoveries.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
It boils down to this. When you're recommending something for somebody else, it's not about you. It is totally about that other person, which means, A, don't hover. Don't be like, it's coming up. But it also means, like, know that, like, for example, I get this question all the time with comics. My first comic when I was like 5 or 6 was a Legion of Superheroes comic. The thing about the Legion of Superheroes is their numbers are Legion. There are a lot of them. And they keep referencing things that happened 16 issues ago. And it's this huge universe. And I read that and I was like, I want in. I want to know who these people are. I want to kind of figure out through context clues what's going on here. I want more. I want to go to a back issue bin and get everything that happened before this. Not everybody's me. A lot of people are going to look at that same issue, even with the same age, and be just like, nope,
Yeah.
So you have to kind of play this tension between it has to be representative of what you want to give them, but it can't be overwhelming. So what I do when I'm recommending, it's not a question of I will recommend you a comic. First, I will say, what's your favorite movie? What kind of television do you like? Because I mentioned this once or twice, I think. Comics are a medium. They're not a genre. So you tell me, if you like action films, I got some recommendations. Try Five Fists of Science. It's a great book. If you like sort of romantic thrillers, try Strangers in Paradise. I mean, this is the way it works. It's a back and forth. It's not just an omnidirectional thing.
And it can't come with judgment attached.
Right.
But you also look for connections. So like 10 years ago, if somebody had said, my favorite artist is the Dave Matthews Band, I would be able to say, okay, you love the Dave Matthews Band. Well, there's a singer-songwriter named David Mead, who I just love, and he has toured with the Dave Matthews Band. You should check out David Mead.
This is how Steven started recommending music for me when we first became friends. He asked me what else I liked, and I couldn't think of anything because I didn't want to tell him because I thought it would be embarrassing.
Judgment.
Because I knew he was a music
and then,
person.
Yeah, but then you found out how many Rick Springfield albums I own, and you realized
Do you remember? I started him with one. I started with one thing that he mentioned that I told him that I liked.
Was it the Jayhawks?
It was the Jayhawks. And that's actually something that I wanted to mention, which is no matter how much you recommend things to people and no matter how much we all are people who love to recommend things, the difficulty for Steven, of course, in doing that kind of backing off, not being in the room thing is when like 90% of your identity is built on connecting people with things they're going to like. Yeah. It's really hard not to have that be a lot of pressure. And I know because I went through like a full blast of that when we first became friends. But you can't completely count out that a certain amount of people's discovery is going to be completely serendipitous.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, my discovery of the Jayhawks came from a commercial that was running on television for the TNT airing of the movie Girl Interrupted with Angelina Jolie.
Alrighty then.
Because they were playing a Jayhawk song. And I thought, I really like that song. That's playing in that ad. I'm going to go figure out what that is. And I went and figured out what it was, and that's how I found that band. Maria McKee, I found playing in a store. And I went and I asked them what it was because I heard it in a store. There are a bunch of bands and singers that I discovered because they were playing in the background of television shows.
Right.
Bunches and bunches.
Well, and commercials are one of the greatest sources of music discovery there are.
Yeah, I was mentioning to Stephen recently my first big noticing of Rufus Wainwright was when he had a Gap holiday ad. He sang What Are You Doing New Year's Eve in a Gap ad. And so there is a certain helplessness to trying to recommend things to people where you can do it. But all you can ever hope is that they will try it. Because there are certain things where all you can do is start at the beginning. There's nowhere to start with The Wire except the beginning.
Right, right.
There's nowhere to start with Friday Night Lights except the beginning. And so you just have to say to people, try it. See if it's your thing. And you have this urge to say, you have to watch at least 8.
Yeah.
And you can't start people off like that because you can't. No. If they try 1 and they don't like it, they'll be like, eh. If they try 8 and they don't like it, then they're mad at you.
Yeah. Right.
Right.
Then they're like, I could have done other things with that time.
Well,
so you can't push like that whole thing. You want to. You want to say, oh, but you can, but because you have to get like, the whole cumulative effect of the. But the truth of the matter is, if you had needed 8 to like it, you wouldn't have ever watched it in the first place.
That's true.
But in most cases.
But it's frustrating. Certain serialized shows like that may start slowly. And so there's sure, a certain amount of like grind through
you
and stick it out.
You can say 2 or 3. You can't say 8. And you can't say even if you hate the first one, even though that sometimes is the case. Friday Night Lights, for me, I did not like the pilot at all. It turned me off. I didn't watch it for a long time until we were like 3/4 of the way through the first season and everyone I knew loved it. That's the only thing that would have turned me around on that show. But you can't honestly expect to make a recommendation to people and say, you have to watch at least the first 10. Like, that's not realistic. So.
Right.
You have to recognize those things where the only thing you can do is start at the beginning. But then you have to recognize also the things where you don't have to start at the beginning. When I was trying to get Steven into Parks and Rec, I told him, don't start at the beginning.
Right.
I started him
Episode 6.
I started him at Rock Show, which is the 6th episode of the first season when Andy has his big rock show and gets his cast off. So you have to be able to recognize when can you not start at the beginning and when do you just not have a choice, and you just have to let people find what they're going to find and react how they're going to react.
Yeah. I want to explore, I want to ask you to either validate or shoot down a thought that I had this afternoon when I was thinking about this. Among the other principles that you might keep in mind when you're choosing things that represent a particular genre or artist, is what I'm offering up to you going to communicate something essential about the form or the genre or the artist? What is it revealing about what you're trying to hook this person on? And I thought of a few examples. There is a really delightful, happy little yodel at the end of Dolly Parton's song Joshua that communicates everything there is to communicate about the sort of joyfulness of her personality.
Mm-hmm.
The farce Noises Off communicates everything that's wonderful about the risks of live theater.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's a single musical phrase in a Puccini aria called Senza Mamma that in the Maria Callas recording of it on Decca showcases all of the taste and skill and emotional transparency that she's legendary for. And I'm wondering if this is a viable principle, that you have to find that thing.
My initial reaction, Trey, is that sounds like homework. It sounds like you're doing the thing where you're trying to impress yourself.
When you talk about something that captures, like, this is actually one of the notes that I made, is that I hope that everyone will forgive me for an extremely short mention of Once, which I know we have talked about a bunch of times. But it's important to remember when you think about that movie, which was an entry point into those musicians and that movie for a bunch of people who didn't have much familiarity with them, is that the most famous song from that movie is Falling Slowly, but the entry point is him singing Say It to Me Now on the street, which I have always felt is the ideal introduction to him, because if you see him, you learn that there is a kind of quiet, folky, busking nature to him, but there is also a kind of blistering, shouting kind of rock band thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that performance contains both of those things, which is why I think it's the exact right thing to start that movie. And he still does it. If you see him live very frequently, I've seen him do it a bunch of times, and I'm sure Stephen has too, he will still step away from the microphone, unamplified, and play that.
Mm-hmm.
I saw him do it at the Beacon Theater in New York, which is a big room.
Mm-hmm.
I think the idea of finding that thing that contains all the...
So an emblematic...
Something emblematic. Yeah. Absolutely. I think I agree with that.
Well, I think it somewhat falls into the category of accessible entry points. I mean, you want to sort of give people the essence of what it is that you're recommending as much as possible. And also, there are certain pieces. There are certain albums and movies. I mean, you talk about Once. There are certainly albums I would talk about that sort of... So many people you know love them, mm-hmm. and you can recommend them sort of with real confidence. Mm-hmm. Kind of everyone agrees mm-hmm. on this, mm-hmm. and that's always, you know, and that's always, you know, useful as well. And kind of, yeah. I mean, I guess there's still that slight element of the fear of being judged.
Well, and it always really helps, I think, to do what Glenn was talking about and ask those introductory yeah. questions, which help you yeah. recommend a book or a show yeah. or something like that. The same way that last week Glenn and I were saying to you, like, you would love happy endings. You would not like American Horror Story, which he was right about in both cases.
Yeah. There's one thing that goes against that theory, Trey, is that when I recommend episodes of Doctor Who to people, I recommend...
You do that?
I do. One of three episodes, all of which aren't the way the show normally works. The way the show normally works is that the companion and the doctor go around to a different mm-hmm. planet to a different time, and they fight some big... thing that looks like a puppet. That's the show.
Chicken.
Possibly an invisible chicken. But there's an episode called Blink, which is told from the point of view of people on Earth who encounter the Doctor at odd times. He kind of comes into their life and then disappears. And you see what happens to them in between his visits. Hmm. There's an episode called Love and Monsters, which I think is funnier and therefore harder to do and mm-hmm. therefore a better episode because Blink is scarier, Love and Monsters is funnier, funnier is harder, funnier is better. And there's an episode called Girl in the Fireplace. All of these are, and I'm not alone in recommending these to people as like the first entry point into the new Doctor Who, because it's not what you're going to see week in and week out, but it's some of the most inventive use of this formula. So the question for me is, do I like it because it is not the usual run of thing? Right. And so is the thing that I value not what... somebody coming into it yeah. fresh would value.
Well, and sometimes you could view that as like the payoff of all these other episodes.
Right.
You know, there are episodes of Buffy the Vampire Slayer that are classic episodes, you know, Hush yeah. or Once More with Feeling, which are huge breaks from the form of the show, are some of the best episodes in that show's history. Yeah. But the payoff of them is so much greater because they do fit into the narratives.
That's the other thing I think you have to keep in mind is always where it fits into the bigger picture. So you should all, by the way, come to find us and find us on the blog or on Facebook and tell us about entry points that work for you, how you pick things to recommend to other people, and perhaps what you do and don't like in the way people recommend things to you. And that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
Well, I was going to talk about how happy I was about the return of NFL officials.
Yes.
And then the NFL officials came back and blew a call that almost cost the Packers another game. Mm-hmm. So instead, I want to talk about something that I had sort of gotten away from a little bit as a parent, and that is reading to kids.
There you go.
You know, my kids now are 11 and 8. They're a little more jaded. It's a little easier to put them to bed. The school year's kind of underway, and, you know, the routines are kind of settled. And I've gotten back into reading, particularly to my 8-year-old daughter. And it has been just such a ridiculous joy to be reminded of how much I love doing that and how much I recommend doing that. And two books in particular that have really made up our kind of new repertoire of nightly reading. One is Lily's Big Day mm-hmm. by Kevin Henkes, who's a terrific children's book writer from Madison, Wisconsin, my hometown, I might say. Long ago, for whatever reason, I started always reading that book in which all the characters have different silly voices, mm-hmm. and concluding with the little flower girl mouse who speaks in a Linda Blair Exorcist voice.
Oh, great.
That always torches my voice for the whole rest of the night, but she has come to really request Lily's Big Day, mm-hmm. provided that it come with voices. The other is a wonderful, wonderful children's book by Jeff Smith, mm-hmm. you know, who's behind all the Bone graphic novels and who's terrific. A very, very cute book. Little bit younger kids, my daughter's starting to get a little old for it, called Little Mouse Gets Ready.
Yeah.
And it's just freaking adorable. And it's just basically a little mouse getting dressed, and then there's a cute little punchline. It's a very sweet book.
Do you want to do Little Mouse's voice for us, Stephen?
Well, if I did the voice of the little mouse in Lily's Big Day, it would blow out the microphone.
All right.
So anyway, reading to children.
Oh, I'll accept that. That's a very, very good answer. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
A Russian play about corruption in the imperial court.
I expected nothing different.
Right. Now, do you recommend reading this play to children?
Absolutely. The thing is, it's Gogol, and it's a satire, and it is lively, funny comedy. It's just opened at the Shakespeare Theater here in D.C., and it is a play that doesn't always work right, And they're pulling it off with a great deal of panache. It's been updated by a playwright named Jeffrey Hatcher, who is a talented fellow, and it's just couldn't seem more on point and timely and relevant. And it's painted in these bright cotton candy cartoony colors, and it's, you know, the costumes are outrageous and the wigs are all standing up. It's terrific.
Wonderful.
It's called The Government Inspector. And like I said, it's running at the Shakespeare Theater. Also, after the performance, I went across the street to my favorite Mexican restaurant in the area, and I finally worked up the courage to have the grasshopper tacos.
Goodness.
Grasshopper tacos.
Yes. Right. So it's no, we're not talking like mint julep kind of like that kind of grasshopper.
That's
we're
what
talking.
I'm assuming. Nope.
They are grasshoppers that are cured in salt and tequila and lime and then chopped very fine and mixed with yummy herbs and spices and probably some chocolate mole sort of things and
I don't know
served
if that sounds,
in little corn tacos.
I don't know if that sounds better or worse than what I had envisioned, which is what Glenn had envisioned, which was mint julep, like tacos dipped in mint julep.
Nope.
Well,
crunchy,
well.
Crunchy, I'm guessing.
Crunchy.
Yeah.
All right. Well, aside from meeting bugs, Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
I went up to Brooklyn this last weekend to see a live show of The Thrilling Adventure Hour, which I've mentioned in the show many times. And, you know, I'm not going to go into it again. It was spectacular. It was just fantastic. And if you're not listening to The Thrilling Adventure podcast, you are hurting America. But you would have been proud of me, Linda Holmes. I went up after the show to meet both Ben Blacker and Ben Acker, the writers, you know, and I felt like a tool going, I'm Glenn Weldon, like whatever. But they couldn't have been nicer. And Ben Blacker actually said that he listens to this show, and I actually was very flattered when we talked about his Nerdist Writers panel and the Thrilling Adventure Hour before. But still, at some point, you know, if I'd been thinking, I would have picked one specific thing that happened in the show and been able to talk about that. But at some point, you're just nodding and smiling and shaking hands, and it's just like, why do people do this? I still don't understand. It was great. I mean, they were very, I'm saying they're very, very nice, but it was just not like.
It's not for you.
I got to go.
They're
you know?
Human.
It's not for
they're
you.
Human beings.
I know, but that, but like, what
could
am I going
to
say to them?
Enjoy them the way you enjoy other human beings?
Well, I mean, what am I going to say to them in that sense where they're just being mobbed by people? What am I going to say to them that everybody else hasn't said to them? So it was fine. In line, however, a woman was in line with me, and she turned to me because I was talking to a friend of the show, Chris Klemek, and she said, are you on a podcast? And I said, yeah. And she said, is it Pop Culture Happy Hour? And I said,
Glenn has a fan.
And I said, yes, I'm Trey Graham, and you are? And she said, her name is Rachel, and she's a she's not a librarian, but she's a teacher, so she figures she can still listen.
Yeah.
It was very, very nice. And then I waited for her to be looking at me, and then I kind of dug into my, I took a big old pick of my nose, and then I unleashed a racist screed.
Nice.
So,
nice.
So you can't go to Ulaanbaatar for a while there, Trey Graham. But that was very nice. Also met Joe Reed for the first time.
Oh, yes.
Extra Gate podcast. Caught up with Mike Katziff.
Yay!
He's doing great. Met a friend of the show, Margaret Willison. So it was a really good weekend.
That sounds despite
wonderful. Despite all the people.
Despite all the people.
I'm very jealous of you, especially because of all the people.
Yeah.
Well, what is making me happy this week? People, I have seen Pitch Perfect.
I figured that was going to be on your short list.
It is very... very awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I am just going to say, if you are any sort of person who would look at this and say it might have any interest to you whatsoever,
tell us about it.
Pitch Perfect is about a young woman played by Anna Kendrick, who you may know from Up in the Air and other rather more serious work. Also, by the way, in the upcoming very bad Robert Redford movie, The Company You Keep. Anyway, Anna Kendrick as a woman who goes to college and winds up joining the women's a cappella group at her college, which has fallen on hard times and is kind of recruiting a fairly ragtag band, of course. And then, of course, they have a rivalry with the men's group at their campus.
A rivalry? Mm-hmm. In a sports movie?
They have a rivalry with the men's group. There are various competition events. There are mashups. There's something called a riff-off. It's completely delightful and awesome. And I don't care what any of you think in the slightest. It does not bother me
all. I watched clips and the trailer for this thing last week when we were putting together the review. And I said to myself, this has Linda Holmes all
over
it.
It is very awesome. It has a bunch of really, really delightful actresses in it. Not only Anna Kendrick, who is terrific in it, but also Rebel Wilson, who is suddenly in everything. Uh-huh. You may remember her from the blonde roommate in Bridesmaids. Uh-huh. She's the one who got like the tattoo on her back and then she was putting the peas on it and all this. And she's in a bunch of stuff right now and she's extremely funny and wonderful. Anna Camp, who has been on The Good Wife and some other stuff, who's very funny in it. It's really, really, I mean, it's every bit of fun that it could possibly have been. It also, none of you have the ability to appreciate this, but it also gets that scene really, really, really right. It is based
on...
Hey,
I was in a Madrigal choir.
It's not the same thing. It is not the same thing at all. It is based on a nonfiction book that was written about a year in the life of these three groups training for the national competition. And so it makes some sense it was gotten so right. But it's funny. It has great, fun music. It is dead on about a cappella culture and its ability to transform dorks into gods, mm-hmm. and that being part of the appeal. It's really, really fun. I highly, highly, hugely recommend
it. And it's actually kind of a big hit, too, right? It did super well on, like, a few screens.
Not a few screens, but it had, like, a limited opening. Yeah. It wasn't one of these that opens on, like, five
screens. No, but, like, 300 screens.
It was on, like, seven. I think it was on, like, 700. But, yeah, it had a very, very high average. They're very optimistic about it opening. It also had, like, a cinema score of, like, A+ with women under 30 or something like that. Yeah. It is outrageously fun. I hugely recommend it. You know, if you liked Bring It On and stuff like that.
It's basically Step Up for acapella
choirs, It's not as good as Bring It On. I won't say that because Bring It On is, you know, pretty awesome. But it is a lot of fun, and I recommend it to anyone who might be interested in it. And I remember so many of the things I used to sing. Anyway.
The snows of yesteryear.
So that's what's making me happy this week. Pitch perfect. So that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon, WELDON. You can follow our producer, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, GITNER. You can follow our producer, emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff of New York.
Of New York.
At Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, still provides our in-and-out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.